real liberalism, mm-hmm. that was your phrase. Mm-hmm. Not a citadel, but a sanctuary, right. A nice distinction. You went there in
the fall of 33.
33 as a student, and came out in 37, 38.
August of 37.
37. And somewhere along that, in that time, you became a sort of self-conscious, liberal, progressive, issue-interested and oriented person.
That's right.
Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, very fair.
Why and how do you suppose that happened in that 4-year period?
I wish I knew.
Do you have any clue about...
I don't have any clues. Because of my father being an outsider, I had thought like an outsider. I had my secret dream that I was going to be a novelist. I had a high school teacher who introduced me to Thomas Wolfe. I had been reading Sinclair Lewis. But politically, I had no orientation whatsoever. Just why I started reading The New Republic, why I started thinking New Deal, all of that I haven't the least idea. I read, because I sold the Literary Digest as a kid, I read a lot more in public affairs than the normal kid.
Were you in the journalism school?
I went, I majored in English and journalism. I got my degree in English, but I took a number of courses in journalism with Phillips Russell. I'm sure Phillips Russell had some influence.
He was something of a socialist?
He was, yes, he was, we all kind of assumed he was socialist. But we knew that he had traveled with the IWW. He had bummed around with radicals, and of course there was Paul Green there.
Yeah. Did you have any contact with him?
Yes. Though he wouldn't remember it, I would.
Yeah.
I was in, the first play I was in was in House of Connolly, which he wrote.
Yeah.
And then I remember I was in Shroud My Body Down, which is another one of his plays.
So you got to know him a little bit. At least knew about his work.
I knew about his work. I knew we were greatly influenced by his work, of course, and all the folk plays that people wrote, which many people look down on now as saying that they weren't genuine and they were written by people out of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some fine ones. I remember a number of them that were written right out of people's direct experience. And of course, Green, you know, did that series of plays with the Negro Theater.
Yeah.
From In Abraham's Bosom on.
Yeah.
So those things, I'm sure, had an effect. As far as...
The social science people, did you have any contact
I took courses in sociology. I took two courses in sociology.
Under Odom?
Odom, not under Vance. I'm just trying to remember two men that I who was kind of a third ranking man there, but
yeah.
I took courses there, and I knew about Odom's work, and I knew about the University Press.
That was going to be my next question.
Yes.
Did you have any association with the press or any of the people who were writing for the press?
Well, the interesting thing is that I had association with a lot of people in Chapel Hill because I had a newspaper robbed. And so I met a number of them in their carpet slippers. And it was interesting when I was in the Army. When I became a lieutenant, I went into the officers' mess in London and was greeted by somebody from Chapel Hill.
Who'd
been on my paper route. And he introduced me as his student and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
He had no idea that he remembered me as a paper boy.
Well, you know... The reason I keep asking these questions mm-hmm. about Chapel Hill is that I have this sense in which Chapel Hill was the only university in the entire Southeast, all the way from Virginia to Texas, the only university with a clear image of a progressive, involved, somewhat liberal institution trying to ameliorate the problems of the South.
Well, certainly Graham and the persona of Graham was extremely important. We all knew that he was fighting Davy Clark because that appeared in the student newspaper. And if you look at the student newspaper from those years, you'll find that it's pretty generally liberal for the time, though there's almost nothing about race, but certainly about labor, defense of Frank Graham. Graham's public stances were known to everybody on the campus, sometimes lamented, because, oh, the legislature's not going to give us enough money because of Graham, and then other people knew damn well that Graham would get more money for it.
But that meant, though, that people really saw him as a liberal.
No question.
He was a left-winger.
He was no question about that. Some people liked it, a great many more forgave him for it, because Dr. Frank was such a good man, you couldn't hold anything against him, even his mistakes. And that was it was an interesting approach. And we all knew the resident accused communist, he never admitted it, and I don't know that he was of course Erickson.
What was his first
name? I'm ashamed to say I don't know. He was a professor.
In what field?
Isn't that interesting?
History,
I don't know.
Maybe,
I think it was history, but I'm not sure. But he had been singled out as one of the people Davy Clark often wrote about in the Southern Textile Bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was constantly being criticized, and the university was criticized for not kicking him out.
Well, the university went through this period that I'm interested in from the mid-30s, let's say, until right to time of Brown, or a little before Brown, 54. The University of North Carolina, well, let's just say up until the time Frank Graham lost his Senate seat.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone to the Senate in 49.
He was appointed.
He was appointed to fill an unexpired term.
That's right.
And then he was only in the Senate for a little over a year, I think, and then lost when he ran for the full term.
Yes.
And in that stretch, from the mid-30s to 1950, the University of North Carolina was, I mean, it prided itself on being a liberal, progressive institution. In many ways, the press, the Odom group and all that, and Graham himself, and I'm sure others as well. After that, my sort of thesis is that it became, as all the other institutions had remained more or less through this period, just not a factor in the social evolution of the South.
Well, I think that when I went there, it was content to be the educational and cultural center for the state. And many people I knew there regarded that as the university's mission, not to be a great national university.
Right.
We had our people who came down from the north to go there. We had our quota of, I shouldn't say quota. We had our share of Jews from the north.
Right.
Who brought many, many ideas that were radical,
right,
as well as otherwise. But that was its mandate. The playmakers toured the high schools. In fact, the first time I remember being stirred in the theater was at, I think, 3 one-act plays that were given in the Reynolds Auditorium in Winston-Salem, the high school auditorium, brought by the playmakers. One was called The Valiant, and the second was the one that Paul Green wrote about the Ocracoke, a rewrite of Riders to the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what the third one was, but boy, my whole attitude towards the theater was set by that evening. And these were strong, socially conscious plays.
Yeah.
I'm sure I was also influenced by the fact that we had one of the high school teachers, I never studied with him, was J.O. Bailey, who had been a playmaker, and taught drama in our high school. And one of his students, who later became his wife, wrote Strike Song. It was Roads and Rain, and then she wrote Strike Song about labor struggles. And that was carried to Chapel Hill. So there was all that
link. So there's just a lot of currents there.
Oh, yes.
And you came out of there in 37.
That's right.
Do you think, looking back on it now, that you could clearly see your own transformation or your awakening or your...
yes, I wouldn't...
rite of passage into political interest and all those things?
I don't know if it was in political influence, but and my interest in politics so much, because, you know, every middle-class Southern boy had to be interested in politics. That was just in the air all the time. You always knew who was running for judge, and you always knew who you'd vote for, even if you weren't voting. You'd know who your family would vote for. I mean, politics was our amusement. But in terms of political ideas, political philosophy, that was something entirely different.
And where were you on that in 1937?
Oh, by 37, I was a dyed-in-the-wool New Dealer.
Yeah.
Oh, heavens, yes. I don't know that I had any more than that. I knew that I was supposed to be for labor, so I didn't know quite why. I knew that I was supposed to be sympathetic with blacks, with Negroes. I understood that.
Did you have any acquaintance with any Negro people at that point? 37?
Not really. You know, I had them on my paper route.
Yeah,
I had known a few blacks who worked with us, Mary and Celia, who were servants in our house,
right.
You know, from the family that lived over on Happy Hill,
yeah.
And one or another of them would come over and work in our house.
People,
but
you...
no, I never knew. And the first person of color whom I knew as an intellectual equal, or one I would just assume was being an intellectual equal, was a mulatto woman who worked for the YWCA. And Catherine introduced me to her. As you know, the YW was way ahead of anybody else in that. And I forget this woman's name, but I remember how startled I was once when she was talking about going to all of these interracial meetings with women. And the women were always saying that it was all right to sit down and work with blacks. So the thing we absolutely don't want is in a marriage. Because terrible things have happened at that. And she said, you know, Cag, every once in a while I look in the mirror and think, what have they got against me?
Yeah.
Look at my color. And suddenly, you know, I had just exactly, of course we don't want to end a marriage. Of course the world will fall apart if we had to end a marriage. And then I heard that. It was this woman whose intellect I could admire.
Kind of a revelation.
And, you know, I didn't even respond to her quite as a black because her speech and her looks and so forth were different. So I could associate with her intellectually, you see, without having that distance of smell and stereotypical thick lips and so forth that would have constantly gotten in the way otherwise. Am I sort of revealing myself?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
But it wasn't there. And oh God, it was, I guess it was 46 or 47. No, it wasn't. It was just 2 years after that when I started working the Myrdal study.
Yeah, very nice.
That I realized that people who smell like blacks and look like blacks and talk like blacks could also be my intellectual equals and all of that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how fast that came.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's because of these 4 years at Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take the year right after that, 37 and 8. Uh-huh. Did you go to New York then right out of school?
No, what happened was that I, after I finished Chapel Hill in September, the end of August, I had to get some more credits off to finish in summer school. I'd been writing feature stories for the Raleigh News and Observer during my time at Chapel Hill. And I was planning to go to library school, and I was working in the library, and I was very good at my job, and I loved the job, and I'd found a little nest of security, and I wanted to hold on to it, and we had a library school there. And then I got fired from my job at the library, and my job just ended. It was a WPA job, the NYA job.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was out, and I panicked. And I went over to Raleigh to see if I could get any more feature stories. And Smethurst, who was managing editor, offered me a job. And then, as I think I told you, I thought, you know, I haven't been able to travel much. It wouldn't be interesting if I could hitchhike and write a column a day and a feature story every Sunday, and I could make as much money as he's offering me, which is a whole $25 a week, which is a lot of money. I always also, I suspect, a little bit worried by the fact that Jim Daniels, my great friend at Chapel Hill, already was working at the News and Observer, and Jim was so much smarter than me. I knew he was so much better than me. And I suspect that just hit me right now. I suspect I was afraid of that competition. Anyway, Smether said, sure, go ahead, try it. So I traveled for several months, wrote these columns, which were published for the News and Observer. And then when I got to New Orleans, lucked into a job on a combination passenger and freighter as a deckhand. Didn't know until I got out in the Mississippi that I was a strike breaker. I got hired just, you know, a day before the ship sailed out. And we had an NMU spy on board, so I found out all about that. But went down the coast of South America, working as a deckhand, a cadet, they called it. And when I came back, I found I needed an operation, the doctor told me, for a fistula. And he told me that if I would go to New York, I could have it done at the Veterans Hospital for free, because as a merchant seaman, as I turned out to be, I could get it done if I had my 3 months' service. So I went there, headed out, and then I was in New York.
And it was...
January 38.
38.
And I had these introductions from Frank Nanny to people in New York. Frank Nanny was the former principal of the Ethical Culture School in New York. You know what the Ethical Culture Society is. He'd been there for many, many, many years. He must have gone there very early because Louis Hine was a student of his, and Hine came there as a teacher in the 1902, 3, or 4. And Paul Strand was there right after that. Anyway, Manny retired, I guess, in his early 60s, and for 2 years, two winters, had an apartment. He and his wife had an apartment in Chapel Hill, and they would hold teas, literary teas, and they were always having visitors come through, and they would have us as students come over and meet these people. And I got to be very friendly with Manny, and he was very thoughtful in helping students. So he gave me introductions to lots of people. Very liberal people, as I told you. One of them was John Dewey.
Yeah.
And I spent a wonderful time with Dewey. And,
yeah.
Louis Hine, Paul Kellogg, as editor of the Survey, so forth. And so when I got to New York, in addition to writing a few feature stories for the travel section of the New York Times, I got a job for my keep and my room, my food and room at Henry Street Settlement. And that gave me a place where I could live. Of course, it immediately exposed me to a wealth of liberal ideas, because we all sat around this big table every night. The whole idea of the settlement was that we would have these bright young people there, people from the neighborhood, and then we would get people like LaGuardia and Eleanor Bonteku, the British MP, and all these people would come and sit with us, and they'd get educated, and we'd get educated.
Yeah.
So it was couldn't have been a better place.
And you stayed in New York then until you went to work for Myrdal?
I stayed in New York until January of 40. Though I did travel, a fellow Southerner and I dreamed up the idea, Calvin Keitel, you remember?
Yeah, I know Calvin.
And two or three others, I got hooked on it, John Creedy and some others. We were planning to have a Southern news magazine called South. I think we actually worked up a dummy issue. And in the summer of 39, I traveled quite extensively through the South, partly to help the Southern Conference for Human Welfare, and partly to see if we could get financial support for this magazine. I had come down South before to the original Southern Conference as a reporter for the survey.
November 30.
Yeah. and I had come back to see my family. So I wasn't, but essentially I was in New York from the end of January, or the middle of January in 38 until I left the 1st of January 1940.
It was during that time that you met Thomas Wolfe?
I met Thomas Wolfe in is it the summer of 30, I guess it was a summer of, the late spring of 38, because it was just before he took that last trip, train trip, to the West.
Mm-hmm.
So I met him for a number of meetings.
I think he died in 38.
That's right. So it was just before that.
Let me ask, I don't want to get linger too long on Wolf, but I wonder if you came away from your acquaintance with him with any sense of what his politics were or how he felt about race and the other issues.
First place, in a very accurate, far more accurate than I can remember, description of those meetings are in an article I wrote called Eugene Returns to Pulpit Hill, which was published in the Carolina Magazine and then republished in a book of essays by Wormser about people who knew Wolfe. I've read it recently, and I think it's a fairly accurate thing.
Where was it first published?
It was published in the Carolina Magazine. The year after I left, you see, and the year after 39, I guess, because John Creedy, who was a great friend of mine at Chapel Hill, and a year or 2 years behind me, was then the editor. And he wrote me and said, would you write this article? He knew I met Wolfe and spent time with him. So with his goading and then his good editorship, thank goodness he edited the piece, it appeared.
Do you think of it as dealing at all with race?
No. Let me talk to you about Wolfe and race. His anti-Semitism was evident in his books. Though I must say that, and this is pretty self-revealing, I thought it far more anti-Yankeeism with being a Northern Jew as the most the most Yankee, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And by that time, I had met enough of the educated, cultural Jews who were, and Northerners who were contemptuous of Southerners, to understand what he was getting at. I remember feeling so irritated because they would either say, well, you're not very Southern, meaning that you don't hate all blacks,
yeah.
Or, you know, equivocate, measuring your Southernness with how much you hated or liked Negroes. Or they would patronize me because I was kind of this little liberal Southerner,
yeah,
whom they could show off at their cocktail parties. But, and I don't know which would irritate me more.
Yeah. But as far as blacks were concerned, did Wolf...
I don't remember ever hearing him refer to race, to blacks, one way or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting about his attitude towards politics. You get it in I Have the Thing to Tell You. He had a bad conscience about not being more political because you were speculating.
Yeah.
You see that in William Shirer's book, or the Berlin Diary,
mm-hmm,
in which he recalls a meal he had with Wolf, and Wolf was apologizing for not being more political.
Yeah.
Because he was supposed
to be.
It was
a political time.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I remember I was with him one night when the phone rang, and he picked up the phone and talked and stuttered into the phone, as he often did, about, well, I don't see why I should come. You don't need me there. You got the Budapest String Quartet. What do you need me for? And a long talk on the other end of the line. And then he slammed down the phone. He says, cocktail party for sharecroppers. Cursing about it. It'd been Martha Dodd on the other line. You know, she was the woman he said goodbye to it in Time in the River,
mm-hmm,
the Berlin,
yeah,
you know, the Berlin station.
Yeah.
And she was trying to inveigle him into coming to this fundraiser for the sharecroppers. And I will never forget that cocktail party for sharecroppers.
He had no interest in that kind of stuff, as far as you could see.
I don't know.
Yeah.
He wanted very much to be accepted. And yet, you see this ambivalence in him all the time. He was too honest,
yeah,
to play along. So it was that constant pulling and chopping.
Two other people, yeah, quickly I would like to just, yeah, mention and see if you have any acquaintance with them. One is W.J. Cash, and the other one would be James Agee.
I knew nothing of W.J. Cash, never met him, and I knew nothing of Agee.
Okay.
I've only known Father Fly, who lived right,
yeah,
across the street from me.
Yeah.
But never knew Agee.
Okay. So, dipping back a little, mm-hmm, bit to the Southern Conference,
mm-hmm,
Welfare in November 38. Mm-hmm. You went down from New York for the express purpose of writing a piece for
Southern Graphic. Oh, yes, that's right.
For
the Survey Graphic.
Survey Graphic.
Not only, I mean,
you were on assignment. Really.
That's right. I was interested.
Yeah.
Lord, I was interested.
Yeah.
And partly because of this magazine we were planning, partly because the people who were going to be there.
Yeah.
And partly because, and I'd met, you see, a number of these people when I was at Chapel Hill.
Yeah.
And so, for all those reasons, and of course, I'm sure that Kellogg thought it would be a great thing for me,
yeah,
to do.
Well, the piece you wrote begins with a sort of a rather blasé expression of your part of what you expected.
Mm-hmm.
You looked up your old friends, the fellow students who had been interested in things. You'd,
mm-hmm,
been from Chapel Hill, and I presume other places,
yeah,
as well, and that you were taking bets on how much of the old stuff you were going to hear.
Right, yeah. Uh-huh.
These old guys, these old sort of pseudo-liberals, in a way, who are,
yeah,
making all of these pronouncements. But you say we were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The speakers assumed we all knew the problems of the South and directed their talk to solutions. And here you toss in some names,
mm-hmm,
people you call miracle men of the New,
mm-hmm,
South. Buck Kester, Tex, mm-hmm, McIntyre, Joe Gelders.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure who McIntyre is, I should know, but Hester, of course,
yes.
was the head of the Southern Tenant
That's
Farmers
right, yes.
Union, and Joe Gelders was the young Jewish mm-hmm. man from Birmingham who had really been the most pivotal instigator of the whole Southern
mm-hmm.
Conference.
Right.
The story mm-hmm. that Virginia Durr tells mm-hmm. about she and he talking to Eleanor mm-hmm. Roosevelt and through her to Franklin mm-hmm. and getting this whole thing lined up is in the record. Then you talk about Frank Graham in the piece and you express obvious admiration mm-hmm. for Frank Graham here as you do now 50 mm-hmm. years later. So I come back to Graham and ask of all, you know, I find myself in this project separating out whites from blacks in terms of their perceptions of the problem of race in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep finding blacks who in 1939, 40, 41, right on through, were saying very clearly, segregation is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we've got to deal with. I find practically no whites who do that. Finally, Lillian Smith does in about
mm-hmm.
44.
Mm-hmm.
Will Alexander does mm-hmm. at about the same time. I don't know when Frank Graham ever publicly said that that segregation is the real problem that we've got to
mm-hmm.
address. Most of the liberal people, liberal whites of this time, came about it in a very blank
mm-hmm.
way. They said, we've got to make separate
yeah.
equal, we've got to live within the law,
mm-hmm.
we can
mm-hmm.
change these customs, but it's going to take time and so forth. Where did you see Graham on that spectrum?
Well, Graham was, I think, if you look at the minutes of the Southern Conference, you'll find some kind of statement about the policies that we would never meet again at a place where there had to be segregation.
Right.
So this was a...
But that, you see, that's a different thing than
sure.
saying we were going to desegregate the
oh,
other institutions
absolutely.
Of the
absolutely.
Society.
Sure, absolutely.
In point of fact, it
right.
was after this date, I think,
yeah.
that Pauli Murray could
yeah.
not get into
that's
the University
right.
of North
that's
Carolina.
Right. Yes.
And Frank Graham never was able to
mm-hmm.
say to Pauli
mm-hmm.
Murray, I'll go to bat for
yeah.
you because this law needs
that's
to be
right.
changed.
Did, the way you put it, you said that he couldn't do it, but did... I wonder if she ever asked him to.
Yes, she did.
She did.
She says in her autobiography
ah.
that she carried on a correspondence
yeah.
with him
ah,
and said, you know,
yeah.
You have this reputation
yeah.
as being a great liberal.
Yeah.
You know this is wrong.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you address
yeah.
this? And he
yeah.
wrote her back a very labored and heartfelt letter saying, you know, I do agree
mm-hmm.
with you and I see this down the road, but I just think it would be destructive
uh-huh.
now to try to
uh-huh.
do
so he's
that.
Saying...
He's saying...
Someday, but not now.
Yeah, and he's
uh-huh.
saying, and as for you now, what
mm-hmm.
I can do is try
mm-hmm.
to help you get in Howard, get in,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
Michigan,
yeah.
you know, some
mm-hmm.
anywhere
yeah.
but here, as
yeah.
the saying
yeah.
goes.
But
he wasn't ready.
Okay, but this is a rather important thing that he was saying it's not strategically right now,
right.
but he accepted the idea.
I think basically
okay.
he did, yeah. And my
but,
hunch is that
okay,
he did.
Here is an important thing about the Southern Conference saying we're not going to meet again. Just the fact that we say we're not going to meet except where we can meet together was a public declaration that there was something wrong with segregation by all the whites.
Yeah,
don't undercut it.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I remember one of the things that came out of my experience in the Myrdal study, and I remember writing a bunch specifically about this. I just hope I could find it in, you know, all that
mm-hmm.
massive manuscript I had, was that, you know, here I was a young guy who came around and talked to people, and finally we would talk about race. And I found it no real problem once I talked about people about elections and about the town and about everything else, you know, and the everything else, we'd get to talk about race. And I found that most Southerners were eager to talk about race on a one-to-one basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times I found them saying, you know, son, in 200 years we're all going to be Kathy O'Leary,
yeah.
or something like that.
Or say, if it was just up to me now.
Well, I didn't hear them say that so much. But I never got too two of them to say that together. Mm-hmm. And they would say it in front of another Southerner.
Yeah.
And so I knew that this was a bad conscience.
Yeah.
But it didn't. I thought it, yeah. When I first heard it, boy, there are going to be big changes in 20 years.
Yeah.
And then I heard that. Then I realized they said something very different if I was interviewing them together.
Yeah.
Or in an open office or something. And I remember remarking to, in my letter to, in my notes to Bunch about this.
Yeah.
A very different thing.
Here's the conclusion I've mm-hmm. come to about the Southern Conference. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people there who meant well, mm-hmm. who in their hearts would have been perfectly willing mm-hmm. to go ahead and take segregation out of, take the whole Jim Crow mm-hmm. structure out of the society. But there was almost nobody there who wanted to make an issue of that. And even though mm-hmm. they passed this resolution saying mm-hmm. that the next time they would meet where they could mm-hmm. all meet together, mm-hmm. they turned right around and elected all their delegates mm-hmm. to the permanent organization without mm-hmm. one single black person in there, and not until somebody got up and said, "Hey guys, mm-hmm. this is what it's all about," yeah. did they go back through and uh-huh. put them in.
Yeah.
And furthermore, so far I have looked in vain for any public statement from Dombrowski, mm-hmm. from Foreman, from Aubrey mm-hmm. Williams, or from Frank Graham prior to mm-hmm. 1943 or 4 mm-hmm. or 5.
That's interesting.
That said, yeah. here's where the problem is.
Let's see if I can get at the reasoning for that, or the excuse.
Okay.
The assumption was, I think, that our economic problems are the root of all evil. Once we can get economic opportunities for all poor people, then we can get to those other problems.
Yeah.
But that is the overwhelming thing. That was the rationale, the excuse, whatever. And also, even though I traveled through the South for 6 months working for the Myrdal study and asked people a lot of questions that you would think I was going to get in trouble for asking, I never felt a threat. The only time I ever felt fear in the South was when I felt that my racial attitudes were being challenged by people around me in a filling station.
Mm-hmm.
At a stop to the road, and I did something, or I picked up a black person in my car.
Yeah.
That's when the adrenaline started pumping.
Well, are you saying that it did because of the way you felt, or it did because of some response that you literally perceived?
I suspect it was mostly my own perception,
inside
my own fears.
Yourself.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'm sure. Oh, I could justify it by other, but I'm sure it was that. See, I was never called down for it. No, it was my fear. It was that built-in fear.
That what you were talking about yesterday,
yeah.
That having this sense that you don't want to embarrass someone else, that mm-hmm. the structure
yeah.
tells you that
that's right.
you have it deeply ingrained in you that you shouldn't do certain things, the taboos and so forth. Well, the reason I linger over all this so much is that, again, one of the conclusions that I have come to about whites and blacks both in this period, late 30s, early 40s, is that whatever they would say to you, either then or now, about what they knew to be the problem, they did know. Race was a problem that sooner or later was going to have to be dealt with. They knew it. They might have said to you, they may say to you to this very day, "I just didn't realize. I never knew how bad it was." But they did know because they read the paper, they saw that people were lynched, they read the paper, they saw the people, they saw the New Deal, they saw people talking all around this issue. And somehow, I find it really just impossible to believe intellectually that anybody who was politically conscious and socially oriented and liberal, conservative, or whatever, anybody who had that kind of perception would not have known deep in their gut that sooner or later they were going to have to face this issue and work it out one way or the other.
Now, talking about our fears, Lillian Smith, of course, gets to the heart of it very quickly.
Very quickly. Very
but
quickly.
I never realized that it was that close.
Yeah.
But the black laughter behind my back used to... Boy, I didn't know how white I was until I used to hear that.
Yeah.
And then I remember reading Native Son. And boy, did that wake me up. Wow. And I realized that none of Paul Green's plays have prepared me for this.
Mm-hmm.
None of all the liberal literature I've been reading, none of that prepared me.
I believe Paul Green took Native Son to the stage.
Who did? Oh, yes. Oh, heavens,
like
yes.
43
yeah.
or something
oh, yes.
like that.
Oh, Paul Green was way ahead of
it. Yeah.
Way better in his earlier work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was intellectually and emotionally about where he was when he wrote The New Wagon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the title of that
yeah.
short story.
Yeah.
Where you had a noble,
mm-hmm.
hardworking
yeah.
black put down by... And embarrassed by these terrible whites.
Yeah.
But I was...
And left you to draw your own
yeah,
conclusion.
But Native Son, well
that
beyond
doesn't matter, yeah. Right. So...
Yeah.
But people had to see, didn't they? Or is that my hindsight that tells me they had to know?
I don't think that... I certainly didn't anticipate... Even after I did all the Myrdal study and so forth, I didn't anticipate that anything like the changes that came about would come about, could come about so peacefully, relatively peacefully,
uh-huh.
and with so relatively little opposition from whites.
You mean what happened after 54?
Oh, yes, yes. Absolutely amazing.
Okay, well then... I think I know what your answer will be to this. If I were to say to you that looking back now on the period 1945 to 1950, between the end of World War
mm-hmm.
II and say the elections of 1950,
mm-hmm.
when Graham lost, Clodpepper lost, McCarthy was in, you know,
mm-hmm.
his ascendancy
yeah.
and so forth. In that 5-year period, it now appears to me the South had its last chance to fix its own social wagon voluntarily.
And the White South.
The White South.
Yeah.
And it could not bring itself to
mm-hmm.
do it.
Yeah.
Therefore, we went through a 25-year period of transformation that was often violent and bloody
mm-hmm.
and all the rest in order to get there now. Is that another hindsight?
I don't think that. Whatever our attitudes would have been in 45 to 50, we could have escaped the civil rights movement.
In other words, you don't think that it is humanly possible for the White South to have had the progressive presence of mind to do what needed to be done?
I think the blacks had to do it for themselves. The beauty of the civil rights movement was that it came out of the black churches, it came out primarily out of the South.
That and the
yeah.
federal courts.
Oh, yes, sure.
Took those two elements.
It took, and without, and they had to do it themselves. If we had done it for them, pardon me, we could,
okay.
in the first place, we couldn't have done it for them. But if we had, they wouldn't have been anything like the strong
okay.
position.
If that's true.
Well, you see, because when they did it for themselves, we had to recognize that they had this leadership.
Yeah.
We had. You see, if we had been doing it, we would have said, okay, we did it. They didn't have it. But they were. You see, let me tell you about it. The educated blacks we saw were almost always inferior in our view. I remember going to Tuskegee when I was working for Farm Security Administration, we had a meeting there, and there were black people reporting and white people in Florida, and I was rather appalled by conditions around, and I remember saying something about that to George Mitchell a couple of years later, and he said, he nodded, and he said, well, let me tell you something that Dr. Will Alexander said. Somebody had gone over to Tuskegee and came back saying, Dr. Will, Tuskegee isn't what it used to be. And Dr. Will said, well, Tuskegee, it never was. It was always a third, fourth-rate institution. Yeah. And that's what I saw.
Okay, but George, how would you account for somebody like Charles Johnson or Walter White or Thurgood Marshall, yeah, or any of the people who, if you go back and look at the late 30s at what they, yeah, were saying and what they, yeah, were doing at that time, they were telling us the situation, and indeed the federal court starting in 1938 was also.
And you see, I was getting to know those people when I was at Henry Street Settlement and when I was at the North.
Uh-huh.
So, and I was reading The New Republic and I was reading The Nation, and I knew their philosophy, but that's very different from having it applied in the South.
Yeah.
And I was nervous. I can remember being nervous about the enforcement of the integrating the schools when we were just beginning to get good money for black schools.
Okay. I hate to jump far ahead, but I don't want to let that point go. Are you saying that when Brown came down, you had a sort of gut feeling that maybe it went too far, too fast?
I was hoping that there would be a time for accommodation so that the better educated blacks could make their presence more acceptable, that all of this would, so that